Very good. Thank you very much. Going to do a call to order of our April 19th City of Grover Beach City Council and Planning Commission special meeting workshop. It is 6 o'clock on the 19th. So this is our call to order. So I do want to say thank you to everyone for being here virtually. We have, as a city, gone back to in-person meetings, but we felt that this was a good opportunity to bring us all back virtually as of the final workshop for this evening. So we did decide to stay virtual, and it's good to see everybody on screen. And with that, let me turn to our City Clerk Sims and do a roll call, please.
Commissioner Holden.
Here.
Commissioner McLaughlin.
Here.
Commissioner Rodman.
Present.
Vice Chair Long.
Here.
Chair Halverson.
Here.
I just received a message that Councilmember Miller will not be joining us. Councilmember Robert.
Here.
Councilmember Rushing.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Here.
Mayor Lee.
Here. Very good. We do have a quorum of both parties tonight. And I should say that given health conditions and consistent with Assembly Bill number 361, we are allowed to have this virtual meeting. So it can be viewed on Channel 20 and is being live streamed on the city's website and at www.slow-span.org. Members of the public are invited to provide public comment during the course of the meeting by calling in at 805-321-6639. And with that, I will turn it over to our public communications, where any member of the public may address the council for a period not to exceed 3 minutes on any item described in the agenda. The council will listen to all communications, however, in accordance with the Brown Act, that are not described, not part of this agenda this evening. But in compliance with the Brown Act, we cannot act on items that are not on tonight's agenda. So let me check and see with our city clerk if there is anyone on the line for public comment who may have called in at 805-321-6639.
No, we have no one on the line.
Very good. Thank you for that. And we'll go ahead and close public communications. And this is a workshop this evening. Our first item is a land use element and development code update workshop. I'll say, first of all, welcome everyone. But let me turn. I know Mr. Buckingham is going to probably start the presentation, but I did want to recognize our city manager, Mr. Bronson, see if he had anything to share with us before we proceed this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'll just recognize the work of our community development department and Mr. Buckingham and let Bruce take it from there.
All right, well, with that said, we'll get this thing started tonight. Good evening, Council and Planning Commission. It's been a while since we last met back in November, and at that time we did receive direction from the Council to move forward with these updates, and there has been a lot of work that's occurred to prepare for tonight by both staff and MIG. The purpose of tonight's workshop is simply to provide an overview of these proposed updates to both the land use element and the development code, which are to implement our housing element programs. The housing element was adopted by the council way back in November of 2020. So the city, as you all know, we did hire MIG consultants to lead this update. And tonight they're going to give us just a quick overview of the previous work that was done and then move on to the presentation on the proposed updates. I will emphasize that this is still a working draft. There are minor clarifications, revisions that need to be made, graphics and definitions to be added, final cleanup. You don't need to tell us if the numbering is wrong. We know where there are some areas that need to get cleaned up. So we appreciate the understanding. So again, then for tonight's workshop, we are seeking comments on these proposed updates, recognizing it's just a lot of material. We're also here to address questions from the public, commission, and council, and then receive any additional direction that the council, if they wish to provide tonight before we move on to our scheduled public hearings. Planning Commission will be May 3rd. and then the council meeting on May 23rd. So again, we'll be working on a revised draft that will go out with the Planning Commission packet and then the final one to the council. So there's still plenty of time to review this. There will be no quiz tonight on whether you reviewed everything. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Genevieve with MIG to lead the presentation.
Great. Thank you so much, Bruce. And thank you, Mayor, City Council, and Planning Commissioners for having me here tonight. I'm also joined, I'm Genevieve Shero with MIG, and I am joined by my colleagues, Roxanne Borzo-Bertrand with MIG, and Jim Hyde of Urban Green Development. And we've been working hard on this project for a while now, and we're glad to see you again. I'm going to share my screen so we can get the presentation underway. So just a real quick agenda. We've got the project recap, where have we been in the past, and how did we get to where we are today? And then I'd like to go through, again, this is an introduction to a lot of material on the draft development code update. And so we'll break that down a little bit with the big kind of key items for you tonight, along with other modifications to the development code, the local coastal program, and the general plan land use element. So quick project recap. Again, this project was initiated based on one of the City Council's four primary goals of housing and homelessness, with the focus really on increasing the overall housing stock and especially affordable housing. So building on that goal and that the good work of the housing element, we had a pretty clear strategy of how that could be achieved. And city staff sought out and received state grants to implement this project. And so we had a pretty clear roadmap from that. In addition, there have been new housing laws that have passed in the last 2 years. So we were able to address those in this process, as well as other minor amendments and cleanup items that staff has found over time. It's kind of their fix-it list as they review projects and things that need to be fixed in the development code. So we're able to kind of wrap all of that up into this project. We began the project back in, I think it was May or June of last year, of 2021, with some listening sessions with stakeholders, local developers, and architects, which were really informative about the local conditions in Grover Beach that we should consider. We also conducted research, compiled a findings report, talked deeply with city staff, looking at constraints and opportunities, and we had three study sessions with Planning Commission and City Council back in the fall, which really helped form that foundation for the project. So while we've been away since those three meetings, we've been working hard on drafting the public documents that are for review tonight. And the intent, again, we really want to introduce these big high-level topics. There's some detail in there that we're not going to go into, but the entire packet is included with the staff report. And just a quick refresher on the topics that we covered back in the fall workshops. At the first workshop, we had some really productive conversations about the development review process. How does a project get from an application to the end of actually being approved and built? We talked about height and density and parking, some of the big kind of constraining factors in how you can design a project. We built on that with a second workshop where Planning Commission and City Council directed us to really focus on affordability by design rather than looking at an inclusionary housing ordinance or an affordable housing impact fee, but to really dig in and figure out how can we encourage more affordability by design. We also discussed one of the key topics that will come back tonight, the objective design standards, or ODS, as it's abbreviated here, objective design standards based on the Housing Accountability Act, and the requirement to really have clear and objective standards for new housing development. We discussed thresholds for requiring street improvements and utilities undergrounding, as well as the state's requirement for the city to affirmatively further fair housing. And then in November, we got great clear direction from City Council on key policy topics, including that development review process, height, fractional density, parking, et cetera. So the key takeaways, the direction that we heard from council from these meetings were quite clear from our perspective, to really look at how can we remove those barriers to housing construction and how can we encourage more affordability by design. So that was the framework with which we looked at the project. So to implement the direction, the development code has been revised in lots of different places. Most chapters have been touched in some way to be revised. We'll go through each of these kind of four categories within the development code to kind of break that down tonight. The first involves changes to land use permits, as well as site planning requirements. So how is a building placed on a particular site? How tall can it be? Where does it need to be set back? What kind of parking and open space requirements are required? And all again, these changes came through the lens of removing barriers and figuring out how can we maximize those allowable densities so that projects that want to build to the maximum density can actually achieve that. In addition, a new law was passed, SB 9, you might have heard of it. This law allows for up to 4 units on each single family lot. And that was passed and became effective this past January. So this project also incorporates a kind of a mirroring of state law to comply with that new law. Other state laws include SB 330, SB 35. These require a streamlined process for certain types of affordable housing projects, and that was also addressed. The development review process was also modified to streamline housing projects. New thresholds for projects to be reviewed at either development permit level by the Planning Commission, administrative development permit level by Bruce, the Community Development Director, or through a new process called the zoning clearance process at the staff level. And we'll also discuss tonight another new permit that was added called the Modification to Standards permit. And that has the intent there is to really provide an additional pathway or flexibility to provide a discretionary option for those projects that don't necessarily want to comply with the objective design standards. And finally, the changes do address objective design standards. So again, the Housing Accountability Law Act and other state laws are really pushing, or even in some cases requiring cities toward more by right approvals of housing in order to streamline the development process. So it's important to develop very clear standards for projects to comply with. And so we approached this challenge with trying to provide flexibility to developers because we know that developers like two things, clarity and flexibility, but some melding of that is kind of the perfect combination. So we endeavored to provide flexibility to developers, encourage smaller, more affordable units, while requiring that certain design features that are really most important for a high quality environment are incorporated into projects. So I'll review these four topics and we'll break for questions after each of these four major topics. So the first proposed change is to a process to remove the administrative use permit from the code. So the administrative use permit previously was reviewed at the staff level, but very few uses were allowed with an administrative use permit. So just to make it simpler, the proposal is to remove the administrative use permit or the AUP from the code entirely and instead regulate through either a use permit that's reviewed at the Planning Commission level, or uses could be allowed by right. And in certain situations, we were able to add additional performance criteria for those types of uses so that those could be allowed by right without having to add what were essentially standard conditions to those. So in general, some of these uses include gyms and studios, late night retail, animal care, and vehicle rentals. New uses were also added in residential zones, and these reflect basically the structure for which the objective design standards were created. So adding these into the use table for clarity with those same terminology really intended just to streamline and make the code as clear as possible. The one additional change is to senior housing. That approval process is revised. Previously, it required a use permit, and the proposal is to allow that use by right. In commercial zones, minor changes were made to the allowed uses, including to allow communal housing in the CBO zone with a use permit. This communal housing is maybe previously known as boarding houses, but kind of a new form of development now that has more common shared spaces and individual units that may or may not have their own kitchens and facilities. So that use is added into the CBO to allow for the kind of changing environment of development and desire for that use. The low barrier navigation centers, this is a type of emergency shelter that has low barrier to entry, so a person can bring their spouse or their dog to such a shelter. These shelters are required to be allowed by right in commercial zones that allow residential, so the mixed use, anywhere mixed use is allowed, so that change is made. And we've also removed the use permit requirement for multi-family or multi-unit attached dwellings, senior housing, and child daycare centers. In the industrial zone, revisions included adding mixed-use projects to the CIC zone with a use permit. Previously, live-work was allowed in the CIC zone, but mixed-use wasn't mentioned. So that is added into the allowed uses with a use permit, as well as lodging or hotels. Low barrier navigation centers, similar to the commercial zones, would be allowed, and commercial recreation facilities, indoor commercial rec, would be allowed with a use permit. So now on to some of the site planning changes, and many of these were kind of the high policy level discussions that we had in the past, and here we have a little bit more specificity for you. So with regards to height limits along West Grand Avenue, currently the development code allows for 5 stories in certain locations along West Grand Avenue, and based on the workshops from the fall, the direction was to expand that area along West Grand Avenue, as indicated on the map, to allow for a 5-story height limit all along that the corridor in this in the area that's identified. And also to really encourage that active ground floor space with a 15-foot ground floor minimum floor height. To accommodate more smaller units, the setbacks in residential zones were also modified slightly to reduce them by 5 feet. This is the front setback, or if it's on a corner, so it would be either street side setback. And so in R1 and CPR1 zones, this would reduce from 20 feet today to 15 feet. And that's measured from it's actually measured back further from the back of sidewalk. It's measured back from the property line, which actually tends to exist a bit further back from back of sidewalk, actually 6 feet. In CR2, R2, R3, and CR3 zones, that setback is also reduced by 5 feet, previously 15, now 10 feet in those zones. And again, this is really intended to facilitate the development on especially narrow lots to achieve the maximum allowable density. Council also directed staff to create a new incentive structure for affordability by design through a process that we're calling fractional density. This is a process where smaller units can be counted as a fraction of a density unit. So the result is that smaller market rate units that are not necessarily deed restricted to lower income households can be more affordable just simply by virtue of the fact that they're smaller. So in the development code, we've structured it so that units that are less than 600 square feet can count as half a unit towards density. If you're between 600 and 1,000 square feet, it's 2/3 of a unit, and 1,000 square feet or more is counted as a full unit. And we've heard and you've seen potential projects that are really interested in this new model. It seems like there is a significant uptick in interest based on applications wanting to use fractional density. So it's a pretty exciting time, I think, for Grover Beach to consider this. So here are a couple of examples of recently planned developments on the left. The design on the left, this is what we currently call PUDs, or planned unit developments. Generally, the layout results in three about 2,000 square foot units on a standard lot. But with these incentives for through fractional density and modulations to the setbacks and other standards, it'll be possible to develop more smaller units. From a total bulk and scale perspective, those three 2,000 square foot units could look the same as six 1,000 square foot units with smaller unit sizes and generally one parking space. So to that end, parking reductions are proposed. For those multifamily and mixed-use projects that use fractional density for at least half of the units, so at least 50% of the units utilize fractional density, the guest parking requirement that currently stands would be waived, and the minimum parking requirement is reduced to one space per unit, regardless of whether the unit's a studio, has one bedroom, two or three units, three bedrooms. For planned unit developments too, the parking requirement is modified to more closely parallel what's allowed in the single family zones, which is that parking can be provided in a carport or an open parking space, and it doesn't have to be in a garage. In addition, in thinking about especially West Grand Avenue and the commercial zones, as the team looked at how development was likely to occur in site planning exercises, we found that there could be significant incentives to reduce the parking standards for commercial uses as well. So commercial uses that are part of a mixed-use project could reduce their parking from previously one space per 300 square feet to one space per 450 square feet. And this will incentivize our commercial uses at the ground floor to activate West Grand Avenue and also make a mixed-use development potentially more feasible. Another factor in site planning and housing development is what we call open space requirements. So open space is generally addressed through setbacks in single family zones, but a minimum square foot requirement is often required for higher density residential or commercial zones that allow residential and mixed use. So here we've drafted a few revisions to provide some additional flexibility by not requiring open space to be necessarily configured in a particular way. So sometimes a balcony or a patio that's attached to a unit is referred to as private open space, whereas a common area with a courtyard is referred to as common open space. We've revised it so that that open space can be provided either as private space, as common open space, or a combination of both to achieve the requirements. And that really helps with flexibility in site planning for designers. In addition, in commercial zones, so these are for the mixed-use projects or residential in the CBO zone, the minimum amount of open space was reduced with an exemption for ground floor units where open space is not required, and a reduction to 60 square feet per unit for the upper floors that have units. And so that can be consolidated, added for all of the units, and then divided to site plan open space in really strategic areas. It can be met through porches, balconies, rooftop open spaces, courtyards, or a combination thereof. And then finally, on site planning, we also have to look at and consider landscaping requirements. And these were reduced slightly to provide some additional flexibility. There are certain landscape requirements on percentage-wise that have been difficult to meet in projects, and kind of modifications have been made. And so we looked at providing some additional flexibility with really focusing on where do you want that landscaping to occur? Where is it most important? And thinking that that is really to buffer certain uses like parking areas and commercial zones, and to provide landscaping really at the front, at the forefront of lots near the sidewalk in residential zones to really enhance that pedestrian experience and the look of development from the public realm. So I'll give a pause there for questions and discussions on those kind of higher level land use and site planning considerations.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Cheryl Shadoff, for that first part of that presentation. So for commissioners and council members, go ahead and raise your hand on your screen if you do have questions, and I'll do my best to capture you and then invite you. So let's see. So I've got Mayor Pro Tem Bright. I'll start with you.
Thank you. I just have a quick question that's regarding the parking reductions. Just a clarification, I suppose. The PUD garage requirement removed is what the slide said, but that's meaning that they just don't have to park their car in the garage. Is that correct? I mean, we haven't removed the garage requirement completely.
Actually, this would remove the garage requirement. As the council actually did for single family residences in a recent update as well. Again, I wouldn't see for people that are building the traditional PUD that we've seen historically, Councilmember Bright, they're still going to have garages. What this will do, because now we don't call them PUDs anymore, we're going to call them detached multifamily in essence. But in order to encourage, let's say you want to have 5 units, this would then allow, it probably wouldn't even be a carport, it'd probably be parking under the building, but it might not necessarily have a garage door.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate the clarification.
So just to clarify, though, there's still going to be a parking requirement. It's just a matter of where that parking actually has a tendency to occur.
Correct. It can be surface, carport, under building, garage. Developer gets to choose.
Okay. Very good. Mayor Pro Tem Bright, any other questions? Very good. Chairman Rodman. So good evening, sir.
Good evening. Hi, folks. I just want to voice a kind of an impression I'm getting with these initial standards that the reductions for parking, reductions for open space, reductions in landscaping kind of yield a crowded, dense neighborhood throughout our community, and it's going to be a real challenge to maintain attractive neighborhoods still. That's not really a question, it's just sort of an impression I'm getting. You could maybe correct my impression if it's way off base, but that's the impression I'm getting. That it sounds like it's come from the direction of the city council.
Go ahead, Bruce.
I'll just start off, Commissioner Robin, by saying, yeah, you're pointing out some changes, but the lot coverage has not changed. The amount of building that you can actually still place in the lot hasn't changed. So it's not creating more structure. It's trying to create more flexibility. Maybe the building is closer to the street. Maybe you want to put a porch on there and create more interaction. The parking reduction, we'll get into that. The only parking reduction really becomes an incentive if you want to do fractional density, which Genevieve will talk about here in a little bit. And the only reduction to open space was done really along the Grand Avenue corridor. When you start thinking about a four-story mixed-use building, maybe not everybody's going to have a balcony. Maybe it moves to a rooftop deck and there's more common open space. But an open space in your residential neighborhoods, that's not going to change either. So just a few clarifications about your observations.
Yeah, I appreciate and I applaud flexibility. I agree wholeheartedly that the more flexibility we can provide and but still protect. I mean, parking to me throughout our community is a problem as it is. We see a lot of on the street parking. Open space, you start to limit more open space and there's less breathing space. And then it's left to the Park and Recreation Department to encourage open space in their recreational plans. And then landscaping, yes, I applaud that we're focusing on landscaping in the front, the most visible areas in order to hide parking. So there's some positive things there, but just, it just leaves me to wonder if we're going in a direction that's going to leave our neighborhoods crowded with cars. And even though I appreciate that's a good observation that we're not increasing the building on a lot, the building size. Exactly. So that's, I understand that. I appreciate and thank you for your comments on my observation.
I think some good concerns and a good response with regards to flexibility and making sure that, yes, if we have the fractional densities are going to allow for flexibility, parking, landscaping, buffering, setbacks, and so forth. So I see Mr. Hyde has his hand raised, so I didn't know if you wanted to add something to the response to Mr. Rodman.
Yes, good evening. The other thing I was just going to underscore that it doesn't have to be a compromise in design by doing this. I think there's a lot of really good, high quality, finer grain projects in the way they're executed. But the other thing I would offer is that what these changes are allowing you to do is actually address the kinds of product that the market is asking for and cannot be built because of the code. So changes in households, changes in family makeups, changes in how people want to live cannot really be accommodated by what a lot of the codes are requiring. And so this is an economic development opportunity for the community beyond just a physical way of thinking about physical changes. So you're really addressing a broader population, and especially the next generation and the way they think about, you know, where they want to live and how they want to live, and, you know, kind of future-proofing the community in some ways by offering a much broader diversity of products.
Yes, thank you for that comment also. That that leaves me with further understanding and some things I haven't actually thought of. Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Rodman, you had your hand still up. Was there another question that you might have? Okay. Oh, very good. So let's see, any other council members or commissioners have questions? If not, I did have one question, and it's more of a clarification. So obviously these are zoning code and development code changes. None of this that we're discussing has a change to the building code. And so from a practical standpoint, if projects do come in and are allowed by right or permitted, there's going to be a zoning code or some level of review to make sure that they're in compliance with the zoning code as part of the building code review, or how is that from a practical standpoint going to be implemented?
Oh, you're jumping ahead.
Sorry.
Real quickly, Genevieve will be talking about this. There'll be a new planning review process that we will call a zoning clearance, but yes, the zoning clearance, the planning review will happen simultaneously with the building permit review. But we also want to take advantage of our pre-application, which would allow a developer to submit something preliminarily, get that feedback so that they know that they're on the right track before they go to the time and expense of developing construction drawings.
Very good. And I'm assuming that zoning code clearance would also include CEQA clearance if necessary, right?
Correct.
Okay. Ms. Sherry, you look like you were going to say something.
I was just thinking I was going to skip the next part of my presentation, which was going to go to SB9 and go straight to processes and come back to SB9s, because I think that'll be a good segue.
Very good. Let's go ahead and proceed in that direction. Let's see if by show of hands, anybody else have questions? Not seeing anybody unmute themselves. Ms. Sherry, the next section, please.
Great. So let's start to talk a little bit about that process and permitting then, because this does, we talked a lot about the development review process early on last fall, and it, while it's not necessarily what we often think of as objective design standards, it's really a critical component of how we're going to streamline development and how projects make their way through the process. So in general, each development permit that exists has to be reviewed by either the director, the planning commission, or the council. We call that the responsible review authority. So in Grover Beach, back when we were doing our stakeholder interviews, we heard from stakeholders that the administrative development permit and other staff level reviews were great, that they really appreciated them. They're superior due to truncated timelines and really clear processes. They really liked them. So that was something that was seen as a possibility to really streamline development. So in order, so currently most housing projects right now have to receive a development plan approval, which is reviewed by the planning commission and a public hearing. So that does take a little bit longer to schedule a public hearing, and there's more unpredictability that developers feel if a project has to go to planning commission. That said, you know, in Grover Beach, you have a really good track record of approving projects and not having a lot of appeals as well. So I think the developers who do know the area can have some confidence there. But in order to really align with the streamlining goals and comply with state law, a new zoning clearance process is proposed. So this would be used for compliance with, if there's a new use going into an existing building and that use is a permitted use, it doesn't have a use permit attached to it, they would go through a zoning clearance process along with a number of other things, including, importantly, projects that are housing projects with four or fewer units or mixed use projects with nine or fewer units and affordable housing projects, regardless of the number of unit size. So the administrative development permit would remain for some certain key things like minor additions to non-residential buildings and other types of things, small type development proposals. And then the development permit would be reserved for the larger housing projects. These are, you know, the projects with five or more units or mixed use with 10 or more units. Or kind of a nuance, if there's an existing development that has, say, that has a residential project and they'd like to convert those units using fractional density into 10 or more additional units, that would also go through the development permit process. If it was less than that, it would go through the zoning clearance process. There's no change for development permit requirements for non-residential development or conversion of residential buildings to commercial uses. This all lives in a certain chapter of the development code called Chapter 4. We also added a new section to that chapter, Section 6.40, that is intended to implement SB 35 and SB 330 specific state laws that really require qualifying affordable housing projects to have a certain streamlined review process. So that process is outlined in this new section. And then finally, we're proposing a new process called modification to standards. And this process, as I mentioned, is really introduced to provide that alternative pathway or alternative process for compliance with the objective design standards. It also allows for some very minor revisions to standards at the staff level, really to provide that flexibility when a certain standard is, you know, 10% off not meeting it, staff can approve that through this process. So the intent here is that if a project does not want to comply with a particular design standard, there is an alternative discretionary process to move forward with project approval or consideration by the Planning Commission. So in order to be approved, the review authority would need to find that the resulting design includes a superior design approach, and noticing is required to surrounding properties because the project would be deviating from those standards slightly. So that kind of sets the structure for those process requirements, and I'd like to turn it back to the mayor for questions and discussion.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Shero. So before we go to questions, let me do invite folks that are on the line. We will invite public comment in a moment. So you can call in at 805-321-6639. But let's first turn to council members or commissioners and see if anyone has any questions through a raise of hands. Not seeing anyone raise their hand, maybe a process question for either Mr. Buckingham or Ms. Shero. So going to Mr. Rodman's comments about what I'll call character of the neighborhoods. So how do these processes and these process improvements and obviously we'll get into objective design standards shortly, but how do we start to say, and I'll figure out how to say my question in a second here, but how do we make sure that the character of the community remains? So with these new policies and procedures, realizing we're a predominantly built out city, and so modifications to existing housing stock is going to be through redevelopment, and so now you're going to have some homes on top of smaller homes from a feel standpoint. So how do we take that into consideration, or what's the best way that the current changes take that into under advisement, shall we say?
Bruce, do you want me to take this or do you want to start?
You can start and then I'll follow up.
Sure. And we'll get into this a little bit more on the objective design standards, because we did think about this really in terms of, you know, the residential neighborhoods, where there's not a lot of changes proposed, and there are specific considerations to massing to address that, to address the changes. And in residential zones, there's no changes to allowed heights. And so it's really thinking about how that infill development can fit in gracefully and focus in on those design characteristics that really help support high quality design. So that is the intent of that objective design standards piece, which we'll go into as well.
Yeah, so I'll just add again, this isn't increasing lot coverage, it's not increasing building height. And if anything, to remind the Commission Council, we don't have any design standards in our R1 or R2 or R3 neighborhoods. The addition of these objective design standards will actually, you know, for the most part, we get good design, but if you drive by and you see a big box today that had no articulation, this is probably going to require some, you know, more articulation than we've received historically. So I think as far as bulk, mass, and this shouldn't change the character of our neighborhoods. And if anything, it would just improve the aesthetic, the design part of it, but in no way would it create more bulk or mass than you have today.
Great, thank you for that clarification, Mr. Buckingham, and Ms. Shero as well. So I see a question from Chairman Rodman.
Yes, I just want to thank the Mayor Lee for his question, and the responses are helping me to understand how we may have some control over masses and how we're already I have seen by reviewing the documents how this is an improvement of the massing that we have in our community now. And I'm still kind of looking for discretionary kinds of decisions that the commission will be able to make. So thank you all for appreciating my questions. Thank you.
Very good. So let me see if there's any other questions not seeing any hands raised, but let me ask, realizing I think there was a kind of a side comment in one of our previous iterations of our workshop saying, oh, what's our planning commission going to do from here forward? I think maybe if you could reiterate that table that you showed at the beginning of that slide, just to show that there is going to be a very significant role for our planning commission as these new streamlined permits and projects come through. It may be some appealable discretions, but Mr. Buckingham or Ms. Shiro, did you want to kind of reiterate that for us, if you would, please?
Yeah, I'll just start by saying, based on the council direction and the desire to help simplify the process, the four units or less, those projects become a zoning clearance. Now, these are two-story homes in the north part of Grover, or our PUDs, those have been going to the Planning Commission. And under this new system of objective design standards, those would not go to the Planning Commission unless they want an exception to the objective design standards. Then we'll be right back at the Planning Commission. So while I think overall, yes, there will be a fewer of these small projects going to the commission, but I think, as you know, we illustrated previously in a staff report of, you know, over the last 10 years, I think there may have been one appeal or two appeals that have even gone to the council. So for the most part, while we've had public hearings and community input, it really hasn't resulted in change projects or denied projects. And so I would just say that now staff will have more tools to use as far as these objective design standards go. So we will be enforcing those, if you will, or making sure that the projects are compliant with there. So with the standard. So while I think it's going to result in a few fewer projects going to the Planning Commission, I think in some ways these changes are going to result in more significant infill projects, and those will, of course, go to the Planning Commission still.
Very good. Appreciate that clarification. So, and thank you, Ms. Shiro, for putting that up. So before we go to the next section, I did want to just, I feel this might be a good time to pause to see if there's anyone on the line for public comment, realizing this is a workshop. So let me turn to our city clerk and see if there's anyone who's called in at 805-321-6639 for public comment on the first two sections of our workshop tonight.
No, we have no one on the line.
Very good. Thank you for that. Then I'll bring it back to the workshop and turn it back to Ms. Shiro for the next section.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And I think I will keep going into the objective design standards, since that's part of the discussion. We'll jump back to SB9 after that. So I will share my screen here. And so, again, just a reminder of kind of why we're doing this. One, of course, this is the direction of the City Council, but it's also linked to recent changes in state law. The Housing Accountability Act really has limited the ability of cities to deny housing projects and mixed-use projects that are at least two-thirds residential if they comply with objective design standards. So the revisions that we've talked about so far really do address that primary form of buildings, really the envelope in which a building can be developed, height, setbacks, with those objective standards. So this new section in Chapter 4 of the Development Code addresses some more of those building and site planning details, and really the details of building design. So the chapter is structured to focus on different types of buildings because there are different considerations as a building increases in size. So the chapter is broken down into four different categories: single unit dwellings, these is single family dwellings traditionally, the multi-unit detached or cluster developments, formerly we called these PUDs or planned unit developments, and then thinking about smaller attached multifamily and larger and mixed use, and larger attached multifamily and mixed use developments. So this structure and the thought process behind it really reflects the visibility of projects and the impact to the larger community, with more design standards applicable as a building increases in size and visibility from the street. Also, some standards for ADUs were modestly adjusted, and new standards for SB9 units are also added. But these four are really the kind of core breakdown of the objective design standards. The objective design standards were drafted to and intended to be flexible and not overly onerous, while also providing a heightened degree of design quality. So they don't dictate any particular architectural style. And projects that do comply with these have confidence moving forward that these are very clear and understandable standards. They have a straightforward pathway to approval. So this is the streamlining that the state is really looking for and that developers, I think, find a lot of satisfaction in. And so, as I mentioned, though, there is an alternative path through that modification to standards and a discretionary review if a project chooses not to comply with these particular standards. So the objective design standards are organized in a variety of different topics, site planning, again, massing, circulation and parking areas, building amenities, articulation or building design and kind of the features. It's kind of the gingerbread to a building. Transparency into buildings through windows, and we also look at regulations for utilities and service areas like trash enclosures. So one key consideration that all of the standards include is a consideration of a new project's interface with surrounding neighborhoods. So to that end, privacy considerations are added to each of the sections to require an offset of windows on upper stories so that a window is not looking directly into a neighboring property's window. In addition, where a commercial zone is located adjacent to a residential zone on either the side or the rear property lines, so anytime there is that adjacency, we do have a few conditions where this does occur. We've taken additional consideration to that residential zone so that an additional upper story setback is required for any stories above two stories to really set that back from the residential zone. We also look at massing here. So in the lower density single family neighborhoods, and this applies to either single unit or multi-unit detached development, actually, the second story must equate to no more than 80% of the lower story. So this regulation used to be applied to PUDs, and now this would be applied across the board. Previously, there were findings about views, and through discussions with council and planning commission in the fall, it was identified that this could be a way to address potential massing concerns and meet those kind of more general goals. To address massing for attached multifamily developments and mixed use, so along Grand Avenue, there's a menu of flexible items that a project could use to comply with an additional measure to reduce the appearance of massing. So a project could choose from any three shown on the screen here. Either a project could step back upper stories, any stories above the third floor, would need to be stepped back 5 feet, or a project could provide cutouts in the building facade of 3 feet by 2 feet, really breaking up that facade and the feeling of massing there, or 20% of the building facade could be set back by 2 feet to really just provide that interest and articulation. So each of these options can address that bulk and massing and provide options and variation for architecture and flexibility for designers as well. The standards also focus on entrances. So the intent, again, is not to be overly onerous, but also to really focus in on what's achievable while enhancing the design of buildings from the public realm, from the public right of way, and your experience when you're walking down the street. And one key important feature in that is a building's entrance. In single family and in the multi-unit detached developments, that's really in the form of porches or some other kind of focal point at the entry. And so to that end, either a porch or another type of focal point is required. These entries must face the street and engage with the street. And in order to make this more feasible, you might remember that we did reduce the setbacks in the residential zones. So now this porch can encroach into that setback and allow for more feasibility. So similarly, in the attached multifamily developments, the entryway is really an important feature to frame the building, provide for a positive pedestrian experience. And here again, we have a menu of options for developments to choose from. A residential-only building or a residential entrance can use either a stoop or a porch or an overhang to accomplish that. Mixed-use buildings have four different entryway types to choose from. The most common is kind of a storefront entryway that we're familiar with, but buildings may also use a gallery where there's a kind of a covered walkway. They can do a commercial terrace where they're putting outdoor dining or other kinds of outdoor uses that are active and exciting at the forefront near the sidewalk. Or they can create a forecourt, which is really like a kind of a setback with a courtyard. And again, this breaks up the building facade and provides interest, intrigue, and articulation and enhances that pedestrian experience. To facade articulation, which is also covered in the ODS, a key consideration really is a way to avoid long blank walls, which really just kills the pedestrian experience. So for single unit and multi-unit detached development, there are a couple of options. A project could vary the depth or do a small setback of 2 feet for at least 5 feet, or they can incorporate porches and windows. So on a standard lot of 50 feet, the building facade is not going to be too huge, and they're required to provide a porch potentially, so they may meet this this with the already required porch if they choose that option. In addition, we look at building materials. The use of either two materials or a different application of the same material really provides just a little bit extra design character that provides that intrigue. We've also listed a few materials that are prohibited, like vinyl and aluminum siding. For multi-unit attached, thinking about facade articulation, there are many different options that we are providing to allow a project to comply with the standards. And the intent here is really to make sure that we're avoiding those long blank walls and we're having a little bit of intrigue in the building architecture. So that can be met through a variety of different ways. An applicant can use facade articulation in the form of regressed features or extrusions, and these are shown here. This can be, we set a minimum depth, but it can be window trim, building panels, eaves, overhangs. Really just trying to set a little bit of depth perception to the facade so it's not a blank wall there. It can be in the form of window patterns, so changing up the window patterns and the depth or projection to provide intrigue there. It could be in a continuous architectural feature, like a parapet or a cornice that runs the length of the building and really helps kind of define and frame that building. It could also be in a change in materials or texture and patterns and colors, just really any options that can help provide that extra higher level design quality that we're looking for. There's also an option to provide a variety in height and roof forms as well, just to provide that additional flexibility. And then we're also looking at those other ancillary uses and things that happen on a site that can tend to be a little bit ugly that we might have to think about. So projects with four or fewer units may use individual trash cans, but once it's more than five, that's really not going to fit on a lot. So for those larger projects, trash receptacles are required to have a pedestrian and vehicle access gate, so both the residents can walk in and throw out the trash, as well as the hauler can pull up and pull out the entire trash can. And the materials on that trash enclosure are required to match the primary building's facade in order to provide a little bit more of the design aesthetic there. And I'll bring it back to Mr. Mayor for questions and discussion.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Sherrow. So appreciate that section of the presentation. Let's go ahead and turn to commissioners and council members, see who might have some questions. Go ahead and raise your hand or unmute yourself. Mr. Rodman.
Yes. Is there a graphic available? I need help in understanding how much an 80%, and these questions actually apply to an R1 residence. How much an 80% 80% of the first floor, what that looks like for a common resident in our neighborhood? Is there a graph available, or can you produce one, you know, before our commission meetings? Because that would be very helpful for me.
Yeah, I think this was intended to show that. I think that that is something that's missing from the code that can be added into the code. And Bruce, you might also have some examples of PUDs that have already complied with this provision that would be a good example of local application.
The one you're showing is to scale, is that correct?
It is, yes. This was done in SketchUp.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that doesn't look like I hoped it would be a greater reduction in the second floor. I'm looking to help prevent the view shed. So in that regard also, I don't mean to be hogging too much time here, but in that regard, I see that you can move that 20% less to one side or put it in the middle or however a builder wants to design it. Would it be helpful to have a statement say that we're looking to have buildings that protect viewshed and the second floor should be constructed with that in mind as a suggestion, maybe not a requirement?
Yeah, and here it always gets tricky with trying to be objective, but then trying to consider all of the things that you want to consider. So in trying to be objective, we can't necessarily say something like consider view sheds, because that finding becomes subjective of where do you measure it from, what is blocking, what is the view of, all of those parameters get pretty difficult to implement in an objective way. So it right. does become a fine line of where can we put those suggestions and also still retain that level of objectivity.
Right. So if that second floor in that graph on the screen is 80%, suppose we change the standard to 75%, what would that look like? So, yeah, how much more smaller would that second floor be to allow for more of a view shed?
And let me turn to Mr. Buckingham for just a second, just to confirm. So the 80% is what we have currently in our single family zone areas, correct? And so this would be carrying an already existing policy into all units, or did I say that incorrectly?
Almost. Right now, the only area, the only type of project that has to have a smaller second story are for planned unit developments. And that's been with the city historically. And that was to try to reduce massing, quite frankly. It was not about views, but it was also to reduce that second story massing, especially when you have these units that are smaller and closer together. So the council discussion and direction was, you know, there were other ways of reducing that second story massing. One is by increasing the setback of a second story, the taller you go. And this is the other approach, just going to a smaller percentage on the second story. So the direction was to go to a reduced mass on the second story. And staff looked at historically, PUDs have been at 80%. So we applied that here. As I mentioned in the staff report, this is a council direction, an ultimate decision. This could be 80%. It can be 60%. What I will tell you, though, is that it isn't going to ultimately address Commissioner Rodman's concerns in all cases, because you can move that second story. I mean, even if it's 50%, you can move it around, but you can move it to the front of the building and it blocks your neighbor's view to the north of you. And if you move it to the back, it blocks the view from the residence to the east. So it doesn't fit perfectly that this is going to resolve all of the issues. It's just going to create, by reducing a second story, increasing the possibilities that more surrounding residences will have views. And if you think of our north-south kind of lot configuration, when someone's building a home in the north portion of the city, somebody directly to the north probably has views directly to the south to the dunes, and someone to the northeast and then the east have some kind of view of the ocean. And as we've seen, you're never going to, the only way you're going to prevent not blocking a view is not building a second story. And with all that said, we went back, and I'll just reiterate that while we have had neighborhood input through the public hearing process, I can't even think, with our current planning commissioners, I don't think there's been one project appealed to the council. And I think, again, we look back and there was one or two in the last decade or so. So as much as we do hear concerns, it hasn't ended up in at the council level to, you know, deny or modify projects. So I'm just saying that I think it is a general concern, but this is going to help address the situation, but it will not uniformly resolve the issue.
Okay, so from that perspective, Mr. Rodman, you had another question?
Well, just a comment to what was last said, that I believe our presenter in our last meeting said that there were very few denials of a project due to view shed, or denial due to blocking of view. And of course, my response was that, well, that may be true because it's always the passing doesn't necessarily mean that all commissioners agree with the final vote. So I'm just trying to have an impact into what could sometimes on the commission, an input gets outvoted and it's not, even though it's in the record, it is not clearly presented in final documents. Thank you for allowing me to speak. Thank you.
Certainly. So from that perspective, let's just, Mr. Rodman has a kind of a lower threshold that he's kind of thrown out for potential consideration. Is there a desire to go with a lower threshold, or shall we keep the 80% that's currently in the standards, or anyone want to venture a comment on that? Go ahead and either unmute yourself. Looks like Councilmember Rushing, you are unmuted.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. To Mr. Buckingham's point, you know, no matter how small, even if it was a 2% on the top floor, that top floor could be moved in all sorts of different ways to make it a nuisance to somebody else's view shed, unfortunately. I would say that we continue with the status quo that we have currently and maintain the 80%.
Very good, and I'll mark all these down. Next, I'll go to Mr. Halverson.
Yeah, I, just to respond to Commissioner Rodman's comments, we have seen a number of projects proposed that were in the Heights area, and there were a number of residents around those projects who voiced concerns about losing their views. And we, yeah, as a council, there may have been some dissent, but in the main, we respect the fact that building new housing and expanding existing housing probably takes precedence over maintaining an ocean view that may be peekaboo at best anyway. I mean, we've had in our my wife and I's house, we've had the peekaboo views, and we've lost them not because of buildings, because trees matured and grew up and blocked them. So I think the 80% is still valid. I think it serves the purpose not to keep from obstructing views, but to break up that massing that we talked about earlier, and also to help preserve privacy from the adjacent lots. So I support leaving the 80% as it is.
Very good. Mr. Long, I saw your hand raised, but then it went down. Was that inadvertent?
No, I was just going to concur with the 80%. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Very good. And Mayor Pro Tem Brecht?
Thank you. Thank you. Well, Commissioner Rodman, I sympathize with you. I have been on my three terms as a planning commissioner, and since then, I have had an issue with maintaining a view. I've never been successful, and I have been advised that a view is not guaranteed. I had a hard time, you know, with that as well. People pay a good chunk of change for their view, and then your neighbor builds a second story, and there goes $50,000 value on your home. However, the view is not guaranteed, and so I just gave in to the fact that at least 80% is better than 100%. And it really does do what we're looking for it to do in the massing arena. So thank you for allowing me to speak.
Certainly. Any other commissioners or council members want to weigh in? I will be one that is sympathetic as well, and also one who has had my view reduced due to a combination of landscaping as well as building structures being constructed in my quote unquote view shed. Realizing that yes, views are not private views are not a protected commodity from a city standpoint. That is one of the conversations we had when we did the reconstruction or the rehabilitation of Newport, was what to do with the view down our majestic streets towards the ocean. And that was a very large consideration as to why we don't have a median down Newport. And so realizing that view sheds down public corridors are a means of being able to address that as well. So I am in favor of keeping the 80% threshold at this point, unless there's other comments that people want to weigh in on. So, not seeing anyone unmute themselves, let me turn to a quick question for either Mr. Buckingham or Ms. Cheryl regarding how these ODS standards are going to practically mirror with our stormwater requirements or the potential for environmental efficiency such as solar panels or other environmental considerations that developers are trying to get into units these days. So is there anything that we need to add or subtract or just at least be aware of when it comes to the intermarriage or interplay between those competing efforts?
No, you're still going to need to comply with stormwater. Again, you still don't, we're not changing lot coverages. As you know, Mr. Mayor, that, you know, most of our projects now have gone to underground basins. They're typically in driveways. Water has to be treated. And so we don't see any changes in stormwater. Solar panels, by law, you're able to install solar panels. So, you know, we have really our standards are very modest and changing roof planes, you would have no diminished area of your roof to mount panels on as a result of these. So from an environmental standpoint, no, we don't see any change as a result of the objective design standards.
Great, that was the kind of the confirmation I was looking for. So I appreciate that. We did have a letter that was submitted, and I did want to just ask about parking maximums. So there was a comment in one of the letters that we should go, rather than having parking minimums, we should have parking maximums. So can you kind of explain the difference for us, if you would, please?
Well, there are, I will say, in more urban areas, and Genevieve may be able to give better examples, because you have today good transit systems, you have a developer that maybe has a parking standard of only one space per unit. So 50 units, 50 spaces. But the city wants to incentivize other modes of travel, and so they might require a maximum of, 40 spaces, or put it in a percentage. They might say, it's only 0.8, or if it is one space, you can't put over more than 50 spaces. The reality is, we don't see residential developers putting in extra spaces. In our smaller projects, parking is at a premium, but I think that is talking about the fractionalized density. That's the one place where the city is going to say, or as proposed, would be reducing your parking requirement to one space per unit if you are in a smaller unit, that fractionalized density, and you don't have guest parking as well. So, that in essence is establishing, it is a minimum, but again, I would say from a practicality standpoint, we haven't seen that. I'm hearing several council members concerned about parking and not having enough parking on site. We're trying to strike that balance, and we're trying to incentivize smaller units, and we're willing to give up there, but our requirements are still kind of status quo of two parking spaces per unit when you have a single family home or a two bedroom unit or a PUD. So Genevieve, anything in urbanized areas, better examples of why they are requiring that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really kind of a different framework of thinking about it too. It's more stick, less carrot. So we're trying to go more carrot, less stick. And it does work very well, especially in areas that have high quality transit where you really want to constrain that, or where you want to constrain the development of perhaps, a type of development that you don't want in that area, for instance, like a single family home in a higher density area. So we addressed that through standards instead.
Very good. Appreciate that clarification. It did generate a question from Mr. Long.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, so just as an example, West Grand, you got a multi-unit mixed use development with fractional density parking, right? So you get the parking reduction, and where do those cars go, right? I mean, wouldn't they likely go along Grand Avenue or the adjacent residential neighborhood? And I'm just, as a hypothetical, right, if we get there, right, have that kind of parking problem, is there any discussion amongst the council or staff about some, in the future, public parking or some other type of, I know there's been a lot of discussion at these workshops, about a potential future where we do have that mixed transportation modes, but right now it is vehicles. Are we talking about a potential charging station for electric vehicles, city sponsored somewhere throughout the city or even public parking? Has that discussion come up as we anticipate potentially, particularly along Grand Avenue, some larger projects that might have mixed use, residential as an example?
So I'll respond from a kind of from a council standpoint. We've not specifically had any capital projects that that speak to parking or new parking structures or new parking areas. I think we've been cognizant of the fact that parking is it can be at a premium in some locations. I think the mixed use development that we're seeing, we're anticipating that the timing of parking will be a benefit to that. But let me turn to either Mr. Buckingham or Mr. Bronson to add any context to my comments.
Well, when we updated our parking standards a few years ago, you know, we brought in a parking consultant, first of all, that was familiar with current trends. We had old historical, if you will, parking ratios, and they provided input and recommendations, and that's what we adopted in our code today. But maybe just going to Commissioner Long's question, first of all, even in the worst case scenario, if you want to call it that, we're talking about one space per unit for fractionalized density project on Grand Avenue. The one that you just saw in pre-application the other night, if it was 44 units, it would have to provide 44 on-site parking spaces. And you think, well, gosh, we wish it was more. Well, there's also a tool through state law, the state density bonus, that any developer, granted they have to provide affordable housing, but that's all they have to provide is one space per unit. And there's, if it's up to two bedrooms. So a lot of cities have reduced downwards to try to just kind of to mirror that, because that is the minimum parking in essence the state is going to force you to put in when you take a state density bonus. And we're seeing some creative developers out there think about this, because in a smaller infill project, if you just provide one moderate rate unit, which is, granted it's lower than market, but it's not much, that sets in that parking reduction. One space per unit, no guest parking. That's basically the equivalent of, you know, where we're at now with some minor changes. So all I can say is, right now, if you go down to Beach Place, our only three-story mixed-use project on Grand Avenue, you probably can get a parking space in the street, if not obviously on-site, because there's not great demand for on-street parking at night. It is kind of a planning dilemma. We want more activity and we want infill development on Grand Avenue. And I think it's just something that you monitor, and when you start to see you have a parking issue, then you need to start looking at other tools ultimately to provide more parking.
Very good, appreciate that context. So let me see if there's any other hands that have questions or comments. Curiosity question for me before we move on to our next section is, you had mentioned we're gonna ban vinyl siding as a material. So is that just becoming an industry standard, or vinyl siding just becoming passe, or what's the thought on that?
Well, first of all, so I don't know if anybody has aluminum or vinyl siding ever in Grover Beach. There were two approaches. Some cities, like San Luis Obispo as an example, they've listed all of the allowed materials, and it's 25 materials long, okay? We took the approach of, let's just put on here what's prohibited. And these were the only things that we could come up with that we probably would say might not hold up over time, or, you know, be as durable. So we put them on the list. Like I said, can't tell you that anybody has ever proposed that I'm aware of a project in the city that has those materials. So this will just assure that it never happens.
Very good. I appreciate that. So let's turn back to Ms. Sherrill for our next section, please.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And so this next section is on recent changes to state housing law. So this is pertaining to SB 9, which I'm sure you've heard of. The development code was modified to comply with and really mirror state law provisions. So again, this SB 9 is the new law that applies to just our R1 and our CR1 zones, whereby a project can be proposed to either split the lot and put two duplexes on each new lot, or do kind of a variety of different configurations with duplexes and single units, perhaps an existing ADU, but in no case really the way that the provisions are written, could a project put more than four units on what was previously the one lot. And this mirrors what state law allows and just really articulates that very clearly for the city of Grover Beach. So the relevant portions of this, of how we're responding to SB 9, exist in two separate portions of the development code, one in the subdivisions chapter and chapter 8. And this pertains to that urban lot split portion of the law. This is a kind of subdivision, which is usually a discretionary action that goes before the Planning Commission. State law says that it has to be a ministerial act. So that means it doesn't include any discretion from the city if it complies with those basic standards. So that urban lot split will occur in Chapter 8. The second relevant portion is in Chapter 4 with our other objective design standards. So this is applying those similar objective standards as would be applied to a single unit development to comply with those same standards so that it does mirror and have that same design context, despite the fact that it might be a duplex and so that it fits well within that neighborhood. However, in no case can the city preclude the development of two units of at least 800 square feet on each, or four if the lot is split. So that is also a consideration if a specific standard would preclude that from occurring. That does need to be waived. We've also identified that, you know, given the 50-foot lot width, it is important from really a neighborhood perspective that we really are only having one curb cut. So that would involve potentially sharing a driveway for the back lot on the flag lot. And this, again, is really intended to help seamlessly fit these types of developments within the existing neighborhood fabric. And these projects would be processed through the zoning clearance process that we discussed before. Because it's a ministerial action, it'll be reviewed at the staff level as required by state law. I skipped the first part to explain what SB 9 is, but I can go back just a little bit. If there's any specific questions, I think that you've been given primers on SB 9. But again, this did go into effect in January. It's very new. There are, you know, many cities have put into place urgency ordinances. There's a lot of conjectures about how it'll be used and what impacts will be, but we really looked at trying to apply it in a way that mirrors state law to be as clean and clear as possible, and to really just comply with that state law. These units can't be used as short-term rentals, just as a factor, but you don't have to be an owner to occupy them unless you split the lot, in which case you do have to be an owner to occupy them. And so the projects do have to comply with those objective design standards. And I think there's a lot of litigation and legislation that's likely to come out of this law over the next couple of years. So we really wanted to, as of this point in time, show compliance, and that is what the standards do. Any questions on that one?
Very good. I appreciate that section. Before we turn to commissioner and council member questions, I will just remind folks that if they do want to call in, I'm going to give an opportunity for public comment after this round of questions, and you can do so by calling at 805-321-6639. So let me turn back to council members and commissioners, see if there's any questions on this segment of the presentation. Not seeing any hands raised. Let me turn to our city clerk and see if anyone is on the line for a public comment.
No, there's no one on the line.
Very good. So Councilmember Rushing, I see your hand is raised.
Thank you, sir. Question on the split lot ownership there. You said that you had to be an owner if you were splitting lots. Is that for both of the lots? So do you have to own both, or does, if I own a lot, I have to own and live in the space, and then I split the lot and I have another one? Can that be a long-term rental, or do I have to sell that lot to somebody else?
Interesting question and point of clarification. The way that the law is written, it actually says applicant will sign an affidavit that they will live there for 3 years. The intent of the law is to avoid overzealous developers from buying up properties and doing this. So the intent is really owner occupation of at least one unit on one of the two lots, that they would live there for 3 years. But the way that the law is written currently is an applicant signs an affidavit that they will live there for 3 years. So it's loose and it is open to interpretation and likely to be clarified through either litigation or future legislation.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Appreciate that clarification. Let's see if there's other members of the council or the commission that have questions or comments. Not seeing any hands go up. Let me turn back to Mr. Buckingham or Ms. Sherrill and figure out what you need from us next.
And I actually do have one more section of the presentation. Oh. If you wouldn't mind, I'll go through that, and that will be the last piece.
I apologize for that.
Not at all. There's a lot to cover. I'll try and keep it brief. So this section is really just the catch-all for any other modifications that we are looking at to kind of advise you of. One other change is a change to the zoning map, to remove the office professional zone from both the map and the development code. There are only these two, essentially three lots that are zoned OP right now. And the proposal is really just to make it easier and cleaner by rezoning those to CBO. There's also a number of clarifications and state law compliance that was instigated by the housing element, a minor change to the public facility zone not to allow housing. Density bonus ordinance was updated to comply with state law. The ADU ordinance was updated to comply with state law. Emergency shelter ordinance, also the overlay zone modified to comply with state law with regard to how parking can be considered. Those low barrier navigation centers that we mentioned under uses, supportive and transitional housing and allowing for those, looking at child daycare facilities, making sure they're clearly allowed, and a variety of changes to definitions to make the use of the code clear, and especially these new ODS, those definitions, some of them are in there. We're still working on a few on this working draft. We also have a few changes in the industrial zones. We talked about the various use changes to allow more residential type uses in the industrial zones, as well as that indoor commercial recreation facility. Staff also identified a few other standards changes to help facilitate different types of development. So in the CI zone, there is the proposal to increase the height slightly by 5 feet from 35 feet to 40 feet. And in the CIC zone, also to increase it to 40 feet from 25 feet. So that would help and really make that mixed use project that would be allowed feasible. Also an increase to lot coverage in the industrial zones to 60% from 50% because projects are having difficulty meeting some of the existing standards. And also to increase the FAR to allow that mixed-use project to occur in the industrial zones. These are proposals in the current draft. There are also a number of other minor revisions, either typos or different changes to the way things are calculated to make it really clear, like, for instance, lot coverage. What is included in lot coverage? We have a whole new section to make that abundantly clear what is going to be counted towards lot coverage to meet that calculation. We also clarified and added additional encroachments into setbacks and height limits. So these are encroachments into the required setback, as well as potential projections beyond the height limit for, equipment and things like that. And the encroachments into the setbacks are for porches and other things. So we've clarified that and made that really with a list of things that are allowed to do those types of deviations. Garage sale regulations are added back in, as well as some changes to the thresholds for where street improvements and utility undergrounding would occur, which we've discussed in the past. There are some very minor amendments to the local coastal program that's required. We have to reference those new permit procedures, zoning clearance and modification to standards. So that does require a modification to the local coastal program. And then the land use element is also, it also underwent revisions, really to look at ways to streamline out some of those really subjective design policies, and really to align with the objective design and development standards that are listed in the development plan. The industrial design guidelines are also referenced in the industrial section, where those subjective policies can still be at play. And that concludes all of the material to cover. So I'm available for questions.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Scherer. It looks like Mr. Rodman has a question.
Yes, I do. On the garage sale, I believe the suggestion was to allow 4 per year. Does that mean each one requires a permit, or is that 4 by right, outright? You don't have to tell anybody, you just have your garage sale. And then secondly, on garage sales, I would like to know if there's any support for lessening those 4 to 2 a year or 3 a year. There's plenty of places to do with your unneeded stuff. You can donate it. A lot of businesses around here accept donations of stuff. You don't need to try to get a nickel for it, is what my feeling is. And they create, garage sales create unwanted traffic in the neighborhood, unwanted types of people that are just coming into a neighborhood just to see what is there rather than coming there to actually need something. So I would like to know if there's any on that. And then I also have a question on rooftop structures.
Actually, before we go there, let's kind of have the discussion on garage sales first. And before we turn to other members, let me turn to either Mr. Buckingham or Ms. Scherer with respect to the first part of Mr. Rodman's question regarding 4 per year and how they would be allowed, shall we say.
So first of all, there is no permit. This is the honor system, and most people don't have 4 garage sales a year. But we do have a few people that will bring in goods that are not their household items, and they will have sales on a regular basis. And that's really what this is trying to prevent. And I can tell you that the neighbors that have concerns, this is something we get complaints about. So this is supposed to be easy to administer. It's 4 a year. It's a calendar year. We just count them up. And when you get to 4 and you want to have another one, then we tell you nicely that you can't have any more, or we send you a violation. So we had some discussion at the council level a few months back on this. This was inadvertently deleted as part of a previous code update a year ago. This is to add it back in. We did a little bit of refinements. It's very similar to what you see in our surrounding jurisdictions.
Very good. Appreciate that. And I know the, at the council level, we had a large discussion between 0 to 12, or almost 0 to daily. So it'll be an interesting round two, shall we say. But let me turn to Council or Mayor Pro Tem Bright for her comments with regards to garage sales, please. And then we'll go back to other questions after we resolve this.
Thank you. Well, I do believe that this resulted from someone in my neighborhood here who was doing exactly what Mr. Buckingham had indicated. They were having an estate sale, and but they were bringing things in from their storage unit, and it wasn't even their home. The mother had sadly passed away. So that's how we realized, I think, that that code had been inadvertently deleted, or that ordinance had been deleted. And so, yes, we did have quite a rousing conversation about garage sales. And we determined that to leave it at the same number as it was before, it's complaint driven. So our code enforcement people aren't going to be out looking for them. It's just the neighbors will regulate. And if your neighbors are anything like mine, you can be sure that they will regulate.
They're not.
Very good. So, Mayor Pro Tem Bright, so that is maintaining the 4, correct, as the number? Okay, great. Appreciate that. Let's see if there's other council members, or commissioners who want to weigh in on Mr. Rodman's request for a number change. Okay, not seeing anybody unmute themselves. I will. We've got a 1-1 tie at the moment. And so I will kind of break that tie by saying I am supportive of sticking with 4, realizing that, yes, it is going to be driven by complaints. And if we get a significant number of complaints for a particular area, to add on to Mr. Rodman's components, that I don't know, Mr. Buckingham, if there's a way that if we get someone's trying to have serial garage sales with multiple complaints, if we could then ban a particular address from having garage sales, or what would be the next steps when it comes to over-exuberant garage sale?
The first citation will be $100. The second citation will be $200. The third citation will be $500. So that would probably be an incentive. And then if they don't comply, we hand them over to Mr. Hale, and he shuts them down.
And I see Mr. Hale has unmuted himself, so I will let him speak to that to that approach.
I think Mr. Buckingham articulated the typical process very well. We give them an administrative process of giving them a notice of violation and then citing them. We give them a period of time within which they can cure that citation, meaning they don't violate it. If they continue to do so, then they get a letter from me. And if they continue to do so after that, a number of options. One of them we've used most often is filing a complaint in court, seeking an order of a court for abatement of that nuisance. If they violate that order, then they can be held in contempt of court.
And hopefully we never get to that that stage with respect to a garage sale. But
never have.
At least we have that opportunity. So Mayor Pro Tem Bright, thank you, Mr. Hale, for that. Mayor Pro Tem, did I see your hand is still raised? Did you have another question? Okay. Very good. So I think with respect to that, obviously this is this item is going to come back in totality to both the Planning Commission and the City Council. So it'll be interesting to see if what level of discussions the Planning Commission has on garage sales, and then when Councilmember Miller is able to join us at the City Council hearing, whether she weighs in more on garage sales. So with that, let me turn back to Mr. Rodman, because I think I heard you had a question on rooftop decks.
Yes. Well, not so much the decks, but on height limits. I get, throughout all zones. It's my understanding that it is requested that we allow elevator shafts or whatever that you have to extend beyond whatever the height limit is. I would like to know if there's anyone that thinks as I do, that if a limit is 40 feet, 50 feet, 25 feet, whatever the height limit is, that is the limit, and all structures that are attached to the roof should be within that limit, maybe with the exception of minor, you know, like a rooftop solar. In fact, that's the only thing I can think of as an exception is a rooftop solar panel. If it's flush against the roof, it wouldn't extend more than a few inches into the height limit. Now, I would allow a few inches, but beyond that, I would think that the height limit means height limit, and there should be no exceptions. Any support for that?
So before we have that conversation, let me turn to either Mr. Buckingham or Ms. Shero to see. I recall you saying there were some exemptions under the code for that strict interpretation of the height limit for, so if you can kind of provide that context for us.
Just to start, there are different types of projections above the maximum height limit. First, you just have architectural features. Think of a commercial building on Grand Avenue may want to have some type of tower element. So historically, cities have said that's an architectural element. That's okay to project above the height limit. So we have architectural features. Then we have very rare, but in residential zones, once in a while, a chimney or a vent has to exceed the 25 feet. So again, this allows that. And then we have mechanical equipment. And I'd say predominantly what we see are, I shouldn't say, in Grover Beach, we don't see these types of buildings that often. But you build an industrial building, and it's two stories tall because that's the maximum height. And then you have all this roof-mounted equipment. Well, the equipment has to be there. There's no way around HVAC equipment. So we want screens to screen those equipment. Well, whether it's the equipment or the screen itself, it's exceeding the height. So it's more of an aesthetic or a screening issue when it comes to roof-mounted equipment. And then finally, it's rather new, but as we are a city of roof decks. We have a lot of roof decks. And when you're in the residential R1 or R2 zone, it's a 25-foot maximum. And historically, people have had stairwells, external stairwells to get to their roof decks, and they haven't exceeded the 25 feet. But there's a new, we have more inquiries now about, well, I'm elderly and I don't want to have a staircase up to my roof deck. I want to put in an elevator. And there's just physically impossible to have a elevator come to the top floor without it projecting above your 25-foot building height. So while I don't think it necessarily has to be 8 feet, we may see this in the future. We're also, there may be a desire to have an internal staircase to go to your roof deck as well, and not external. So those are two cases we're starting to see more of. On a commercial building, though, we saw it on the proposal for the pre-application at 4th and Grand. They want to have a public rooftop and a private rooftop deck. Again, you got to have access through elevators and stairwells. I think in those projects, because you have a bigger footprint, we're not going to have those right on the edge of a building unless it's an architectural feature. We're going to push those, again, large projects, discretionary review. We're going to say those things need to be pushed towards the center of the building, and I don't think that they're going to be visible at all. And if they had to be architecturally enhanced, they would be. So I think we still don't see this a lot. Again, we're trying to create flexibility. I'll give you the best example that I can think of is the Grover Beach Lodge, 40-foot maximum height, but they wanted a roof deck. They wanted to have access. So ultimately, the council did approve through the previous process, which was a use permit. This is just now allowing the review authority, whether that's staff, the planning commissioner, or the city council, to allow these features to be part of the project.
And actually, that was going to, thank you, Mr. Buckingham, for bringing that up, because that was going to be my understanding of the code requirements or the desired view height limits being kind of in line with what is needed for the building, whether it be architectural or mechanical, HVAC, but still having them set back for the aesthetics. So, Ms. Shero, did I see your screen go live? Did you want to add context?
No, I think Bruce summarized that really well.
Okay, very good. Let's see, I don't see anybody's hands raised. So I'll take that as kind of confirmation that the approach that we have in place is the way that both the Planning Commission and the Council would like to proceed at this time. So thank you, Mr. Rodman, for your for reaching out, though. And let me turn back to one last time to our city clerk, see if anyone has called in at 805-321-6639 for comments on any part of the presentation.
I have no one online.
Very good. Then we'll go ahead and close public comments, bring it back to one last round of comments or questions for either Mr. Buckingham, Ms. Shero, or any members of the team. So go ahead and raise your hand. Mayor Pro Tem Bright, I see you unmuted yourself. Oh, now your hand is raised.
I did. You know, it takes me a while, but I do learn eventually how to raise that bloody hand. No, really, I just really wanted to thank staff and Ms. Shero and her staff. I know this could not have been easy to put together in such a concise format, and it really is appreciated by me. Made it very easy for me to understand, and that's very much appreciated. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you for those kind words, for all of the information that staff and the consultant team has put together. Let's see if there's any other comments that people want to share. Not seeing anybody come forward. Let's turn it over to Mr. Buckingham and Shero to kind of neatly wrap this up. I'll just also express my appreciation for all the hard work that has gone into this. And let's just make sure that you've received all of the input and direction that you needed from us tonight, or if there's more work that we need to do prior to it coming to Planning Commission and or City Council on the next dates.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor. First of all, I'll just say there is a lot of information, and the point of tonight's meeting was this is the introduction. You can still ask questions, changes can still be made. This is not set in stone. This was, again, on purpose to provide an opportunity for you to review it in advance, ask questions. But again, we have a Planning Commission and a City Council meeting still scheduled. I did not hear anything tonight that would change the direction of what you have before you. So it will proceed through the process. As I said, we will be making some minor changes, and in the next staff report, we will identify those so that you can clearly see what additions were added. But at this point, I don't have any other comments. Again, I just appreciate the commission and council coming together and hearing us out and getting an overview of this project.
Very good. Ms. Shero, any closing comments?
Not a one. Just thank you so much for your time and guidance in this process.
Okay, very good. So I guess one last practical question is, realizing that we do have a Planning Commission and a City Council meeting, are you actually going to be doing them remotely, or are you going to come see us?
I will come see you.
Okay, very good. Then we'll look forward to seeing you in person at the next two meetings. Unless there is anything else tonight by a raise of a hand. Seeing none. So I will say thank you, everyone, for your time and your effort tonight, and we'll look forward to next steps. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night, everyone.
Good work, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Good job.